Hello and welcome back to the Unseen Incidents podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten, and on this week's episodes, we take a look ahead at the Champions League final, we discuss Mauricio Pochettino's Chelsea exit, and we open the burn book. While over on the paid side, we get into the big question, should VAR be scrapped? And then we give you our summer clothing picks. That's all on this week's episodes of Unseen Incidents. So hello, we're back for another two episodes of Unseen Incidents, and as always, I'm joined by Pete Dorman. How are you doing, Pete?
I'm very, very well. Happy to be here, Patrick. How are things with you? I always ask you this. Literally, this is the past three or four episodes that we've done. I've always asked you how you are just as you reach and start to drink some whatever drink you brought with you. It's kind of like when you're at a restaurant and you take like a massive bite just as the waiter comes over and asks you if you're enjoying your meal. And then there's always that awkward, like, half, you don't want to speak with your mouth full, but you don't want to be rude and just be, like, dismissive. So then you try and fumble your way through some, yeah, it's really, really lovely, while having a full mouthful of food. I feel like that's, I'm always putting you in that situation.
Yeah, well, I don't want to be dismissive with you, but like, with a waiter, like, I'm very nice to waiters, but if somebody asks me a question just as I, like, put a bunch of food in my mouth, I'm like, I'm kind of look at them like, you're a waiter. Like, this must happen a lot. Like, you're telling me that you've never gone up to ask someone a question just they put something in their mouth before? Sure you have. Just leave it, bro. Like, so I really appreciate it when they ask and then they see you put something in your mouth and they just like give you the thumbs up, or they're just like, okay. And I appreciate that, because otherwise I'm like, I kind of shrug at them like, what do you want me to do here?
So it must be confirmation bias, because I only ever remember when it happens. It seems to happen all the time, but I think that's all largely because I only ever remember the times it happens. Like, I never remember the times when I'm sitting there without anything in my mouth and say, yeah, this is really lovely, thank you. Those ones just fall into the ether, but you remember the awkward ones. And then subsequently that feels like every time a waiter speaks to you, you've got just half a fucking steak in your mouth.
To be honest with you, I have very strict rules about stuff like this. So when someone does something that I consider to be like their fault, like they're basically making me be rude because they've been stupid, I'm kind of like...
it's their fault that you're rude.
Yeah, I'm like, this is on you.
At what point does that become victim blaming?
No, it's not. Are you saying you're the victim? Unless I say something really... I am the victim. Unless I say something really bad, I would say there's no victim there. But I never say anything really bad to a waiter. Sure. Like, it's more that I'm just kind of like, I don't feel bad about being rude because I'm like, you're the architect of this. It's the same way that, like, I think Emma maybe gets faintly embarrassed that, like, sometimes, you know, when someone's blocking the pavement, and we walk up to them and then they stand aside, Emma will say thank you. And I don't, because I'm like, you don't get a thank you for not blocking the pavement. If you'd been standing aside in the first place, I wouldn't have said
thank you. Oh, is this a stationary person?
What do you mean?
As in, like, it's not somebody walking slowly in front of you. It's somebody literally standing still in the middle of a walkway.
Yeah. If somebody's walking, people are entitled to walk at their speed. Yeah. But when someone's standing there and then they move aside and they look at you like they expect to thank you, and you're like, if you'd been standing to the side in the first place, I wouldn't have said thank you. So why should I thank you because you did something bad by standing in the way and then I had to wait for you to move? Get fuck out of the way. So there's stuff like that where I just look at them and I'm just like, I'm not going to say thank you for this because it doesn't deserve a thank you. And sometimes they like huff and puff and I'm just like, this is on you, bro. This is on you. Like, so in those situations, I'm just like, it's a really strong principle where I'm just like, I refuse to say thank you for this.
I respect
bullshit.
That.
Thank you.
Also, if you're going to stand still, don't do it in the middle of a walkway.
I know. Don't do the thing as well. You know, where people, and I feel like a lot of old people do this because maybe they think they're smaller than they are, but like they do this sort of half step to the side and you're like, but they're not actually out of the way, especially when I've got the pram. Pram's fucking massive. And like they take like a half step to the side. And like, so in those situations, I say, I still can't get past. Or I say, you're blocking the way. And they're like, and then they kind of like shuffle to the side. And you're like, well, it's not my fault that you don't have any spatial awareness, you stupid bastard.
What I find infuriating is like when you get off the tube or the, like you're coming out of the turnstiles and you either do Apple Pay or your card and the person in front of you goes through. and then takes like one, two steps and immediately stops to either like look at their phone.
Oh my God.
Or to put their purse or whatever back in their bag, but they come to a full standstill. And obviously this is London, so there's going to be, what, like three people through that turnstile every 2 seconds? So it's like it just backs up instantly just because this person can't like take four more steps and walk to the side.
Oh my God, the same thing getting off the bus. People step off the bus and just stop. People walk out of shops backwards, you know, like saying, oh, bye. Like, walk out of the shop backwards. And like, when someone just bumps into me, I'm like, you fucking idiot. And when I say I'm like, you fucking idiot, I mean, I say, you fucking idiot. Like, when people get off the bottom of like an escalator on the tube, but really, really slowly. And then you're trying to get off like in such a way that you don't bump into them, but also in such a way that the person behind you doesn't bump into you. Yeah. You know, like you're trying to like solve their idiocy.
Yeah.
All this kind of stuff. I'm just like, get out of the way. And Emma's, this is genuinely Emma's like biggest hate that I do. And this, to be honest, is one of the cuntiest things I do. I will clap at people. like imagine if you had some geese like in front of you and you were trying to like chivy them like away from you. Yeah. Like, I would be like, and I'll like gesticulate like, come on. And I know it is really dickish, but I find myself doing it automatically at people. And when I do that, I'm just like, I'm treating this person like a horse or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not,
you're hurting them like sheep.
I'm not really proud of it, but I do just sort of automatically do it. When I'm like, hurry up, I'll just start like clapping at them. It's really bad.
I appreciate that you're...
No, you shouldn't. Don't encourage
us. I appreciate that in isolation, but I appreciate more that you're in your mid-30s, but you seem to have reached like the point of zero fucks that usually are reserved for people that are like 60.
I think I'll have more fucks at 60. Mm. Like my dad, when I was under 10, had like... was very intolerant, very impatient, and like reasonably short temper. And we were always like, don't get on dad's bad side, like mum's softer. And by the time I was like 13, 14, I was like, my dad doesn't give a shit anymore. My dad's so chill. And my mum has become like the tyrant. And my dad has got more and more chill with every passing year, to the point that now he's like unbelievably relaxed and chill. And my aunt's the same. Like my aunt was like, a lunatic spitfire when she was younger. She was basically like my grandfather, who was kind of a maniac. And now she's like almost as chill as a regular person. No, that's not true. She's like, she's significantly more chill than I am.
Yeah, but
which
being
is good,
chill...
Which is progress for her.
Yeah, but I feel that being chill and giving no fucks are two different things.
Okay,
like,
well, whatever.
It's not that you're not chill or not chill. It's not like you don't care who you offend in those situations. I feel that's usually reserved for older people who are like, I don't care anymore what people say.
It's more that I just have very strict lines. Like, I don't really want to offend people. But when I feel like someone's transgressed one of my boundaries, then I do sort of think, it's like, you know, Americans who are like, well, if somebody like walks up my drive, like looking shifty, then I'm allowed to just fucking shoot them in the head. You know, and that's kind of how I feel. I'm like, if somebody inconveniences me to a certain extent, like beyond a certain point, or if they do something really selfish, I'm like, you're doing something really selfish. I do think it needs to be pointed out to you that you're being like, you're not being thoughtless. You haven't like, it's not like you don't understand. Like when it's a tourist and they're like standing on the wrong side of the escalator, I don't get that annoyed because I'm just like, I don't know that you understand the signs. Like you're not from London. I don't know. I don't want to ruin your holiday. I don't have an issue with this. I really don't mind. I'll say excuse me, or I'll tap them on the shoulder if they don't notice. But it's like, that's fine. It's when somebody who should know better is being selfish, then I'm like, no, I refuse to like sanction your buffoonery. Like, I'm not having this.
I do respect all of that, but I do feel that using the stand your ground laws in America as a justification or comparison probably don't paint you in as good a light as another analogy might have.
Sure, though I would say that the stand your ground, often what someone does in order to get shot is very little, and getting shot is quite a severe punishment. Yeah, yeah. Whereas in my scenario, someone transgresses a bit, you know, more severely in that they will like do something selfish or stupid, and I don't
clap
like shoot them, I just clap at them or tell them they're a fucking idiot.
Herd them like sheep.
Well, somebody needs to. I just think that if London employed a few sheepdogs... You know, like, so in Japan, there are the guys on the platform who push people onto the train.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just have a few of those, but they push people onto the tracks instead. They're just like, no.
Yeah, you've had your chance.
No,
The world doesn't need
We need to send a message.
Yeah.
let this be a lesson to you.
The jeopardy needs to be higher.
Yeah. I just think they should say that. They should be like, there are stakes here. And the stakes aren't like, oh, whoopsie. Oh, sorry. Oh, I'm so silly, aren't I? Like, no. The stakes are like, maybe you die. Hunger
this
Games.
Might be the earliest we get cancelled in an episode in history.
We're on cancel. 10
minutes
Pete.
In. I'm not
we
so sure.
Cannot be cancelled. Yeah, I don't know about that. Yeah. Regret saying that. Okay, shall we move on then? Because we've got some football content. So we're going to talk about the Champions League final first, before we get to the Pochettino stuff. So we were kind of like kicking around topics, and then it was like, oh, Pochettino's left Chelsea. We should probably cover that. It's nice when you're trying to come up with a topic and then one of the dumbest clubs in football does something dumb. But before that, should we deal with the Champions League final, which I know we all... are just absolutely perplexed as to how this final might go. Like, who could possibly have a prediction for who would win this final? Like, I mean, it does feel... I'm not saying it's guaranteed, obviously, and we'll get into why, but it does just feel like a mismatch. Like, Real Madrid are Spanish champions. Real Madrid are on, like, 94 points, by the way. I didn't realise that. They've lost one game in La Liga all year. And in the knockouts, the last two knockout fixtures, Man City and Bayern, they've beaten. Dortmund finished fifth in the Bundesliga, had the easiest run in the knockouts of any side. Like, I mean, when they were the worst side, they would draw the second worst side. They had PSV, they had Atleti, then they had PSG. And despite that, I looked at their XG. In all their knockout matches, they were the inferior team by XG. Every one of the games. Not like the two legs overall.
Yeah, every single
game. Every one of the games. And in fact, across their 12 Champions League matches this season, they've only had more XG than their opponents in two. And both of those were against Newcastle.
That's staggering. They're in the final of the Champions League.
So it feels like they should win.
Well, as in, like, it's written in the stars. This is like Greece in Euro 2000.
The only explanation for them reaching this point is, like, that God wants it to happen.
Yeah.
So they
did some weird
win.
Voodoo like, dance. And then exactly. Dortmund before the Champions League draw.
It would be really funny as well if they Real Madrided Real Madrid. Like, Real Madrid won the Champions League a bunch of times doing this under Zidane, where they would play like Bayern. They would be solidly inferior. They would score two offside goals that UEFA was like, whoops. And then they'd win the Champions League. And every time everyone was like, it's just destiny. And you're like,
All of those times there were a significantly better team than this Dortmund team are. Even sure, if they were inferior to their opponents.
Yeah, but like... I don't know. I mean, like, there were games in there where they were more solidly, like, outplayed. For instance, some of the Bayern games, where they were more solidly outplayed than Dortmund were against, like, PSG. I thought Dortmund pretty good against PSG in the first leg. Maybe not the second.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. Anyway, how are you feeling about this? Do you have a glimmer of hope here? Because I've been trying to talk myself into it.
Which and is
I'm
never
not
a good sign.
I'm not succeeding, Pete.
Yeah, So I was actually more, across this whole season, I've been more bullish on Madrid than you have been. I think certainly at the start of the season and kind of mid-season, you were quite down on Madrid. And I think my predictions for the Champions League were actually an Arsenal-Barca final, which was a fantastic prediction. But I think that was more me being like inflammatory and also wanting Arsenal to get to the final.
This is football like heritage.
And I kind of feel like Barca should have dispatched with PSG, especially after leading the first leg.
But agree with that.
Anyway... I was always quite bullish on Madrid doing something this season and going far in the Champions League. And I have been the exact opposite on Dortmund. And Dortmund, statistically, were the worst team in the last eight. They were the worst team in the last four. They've been the worst team pretty much since, the quarterfinals. Maybe even before that, maybe last 16.
They weren't the worst team in the round. I don't know. They kind of had the worst numbers in the round of 16.
I would need to look that up, but it doesn't paint them in a good light.
I'm going to look it up while you talk.
All of their underlying numbers, terrible. And Real Madrid, like you say, have just like kind of quietly gone about their business really effectively this season. They are just a legitimately decent team.
I'm just going to interrupt you to say they did in fact have the worst XG difference of any team to make the round of 16.
Yeah.
It was more than... They had minus 0.43 XG difference per 90, which was significantly worse than Copenhagen's
minus 0.4 is bad.
Yeah, to put that in context, let's find out. To put that in context, a Premier League side this season that had about that XG difference per 90, it would place them 2019, 18, 17, 16. It would place them 15th in the table between Manchester United and West Ham, who both finished in the top half. But it'd be worse than Fulham. It'd be worse than Forest. It'd be worse than Palace, Bournemouth, Everton, Brighton, Brentford. Pretty bad.
But also, United and West Ham both had like oddly bad XG diff per 90s this season.
Yeah, it's just that, you know, when you if you order the table by expected goal difference per 90, Arsenal number one, annoying. But then you've got like you've just got two teams that are actually finished in the top half in the bottom half, and they are Man United and West Ham.
But yeah, like Dortmund have just been not a great team for the entirety of this knockout stages in terms of their underlying numbers, and they've just managed to get it done. But when I look at the two squads, when I look at how I think the game will kind of unfold, I think it's really, really difficult to see a way that Dortmund actually cause an upset. It's obviously possible. Like, this is a one-off game. You know, they could go and, like you say, Real Madrid. But I don't see a huge amount of quality in their squad in terms of, like, absolute game changers. Like people you can say, that guy will stand up and be counted on the night, and he'll make the difference. Whereas you look at Real Madrid and you see Vinicius, you see Bellingham, you even see like the way Joselu, who has not necessarily an integral part to Real Madrid, but he has been a very, very influential part and came up huge in the semi-final. Like, Real Madrid just have a lot more firepower and reliability in those big moments throughout their squad than Dortmund have. And, you know, Jadon Sancho had a great game, particularly in the first leg against PSG. But everybody on social media kind of like started rimming him after that and were like, oh, United shouldn't have let him go, etc., etc., etc. He had a good game and Nuno Mendes had a bad game. And that was kind of it.
I mean, he did have a good game.
He had an amazing game, and Nuno Mendes had a terrible game. But I look around that squad, and outside of that moment, I haven't really seen anything like that from Dortmund this season in the Champions League.
But you do kind of just need that moment. Like, as in...
Yeah, I'm not saying it's not possible. I'm just saying that there are a significantly less number of people, I believe, can do that in the Champions League final than there are in the Real Madrid squad.
I agree with that. But what I would say, yes, you've been more positive on Real Madrid than me all season. But I do think a team like Real Madrid, this Real Madrid team, I do think they're inferior to, say, Manchester City.
Oh, I agree.
And where that difference matters is that it's more possible that Dortmund could, like if Dortmund got lucky against Manchester City in a bunch of ways, you know, like two of their guys showed up and had huge games, that's less likely to be enough to win the tie than it is against a team like Real Madrid.
Sure.
Because Man City, I think, are that much better than Real Madrid. Now, you know, people can argue about this and Champions League final and blah, blah, blah. But like, even compared to other Real Madrid's team's numbers, this Real Madrid team is like not really as good as its performance in the league. You know, like its underlying numbers are only okay by Real Madrid standards. They're still very, very good, but they're only okay by Real Madrid standards. And that can be the difference. Like, I don't think it will be, because I was basically thinking about it and I was like, what are the scenarios in which Dortmund managed to do something here? And obviously scenario one is like the one it always is, which is you just score. Like, you create a big chance or two and one of them goes in, or you just have a shot from range that goes in, and that's how it happens. You
we know, kind of saw the same way last night in the Europa League final. Like, Lookman scored three goals from three shots. Obviously, Atalanta were a lot better than Leverkusen and played a really, really, like implemented a game plan really, really well. But when you look at Lookman's chances, certainly the second and third one, reasonably low XG and really well taken moments that define the game.
Sure, but like, I mean, but also I think that they did have the opportunity to, they could have created bigger chances on the break, for example. Like in a way, the game I would use as an example of this is something like Arsenal-Newcastle in the autumn when Newcastle won. That game was almost like there was no XG in it. Like, there were no chances in that game. Nobody did anything except for that one, you know, controversial chance, like, which is how Newcastle got their goal and like won the game.
Yeah.
Like, but nothing, basically there were no events in the game except that one thing. And so you can imagine a match somehow where like very little happens, but like Dortmund just happened to get the chance and score it. And that's the difference. Or, you know, someone just puts one in from 40 yards and that's it. That's option one. Option two is they do actually manage to disrupt Real's possession game with the press, and that gets them chances and stops Real getting chances. That is what they're going to try and do. That's what they've been doing in the Champions League. It's what they do in the Bundesliga. They're one of the highest pressing sides in the Bundesliga. They press much harder than Bayern. They press harder than Leverkusen. The downside of
against Real, though.
Well, here's the thing. Mm. I also think that that's a hard press relative to the Bundesliga. But the Bundesliga is not a very pressy league at the moment. And I think that you could definitely see that in the Europa League final. Like, Leverkusen looked like they had absolutely no idea what to do when Atalanta were pressing them that hard. They looked like they had no idea. And if you compare the... So one way to look at the success of a press is opposition pass completion.
Mm.
So if you hold your opponents to a lower pass completion than they normally have, that's kind of suggestive of your press being able to, like, block passing lanes or put them under pressure so that they're playing worse passes, you know, all those sorts of things. And the opposition pass completion against Dortmund is nearly 78%. Well, there are like six or seven teams in La Liga who press harder than that, including and especially Barcelona and Real Sociedad. Like, those are teams that are both good and like Las Palmas press hard as well, but they're not as good as Sociedad or Barcelona. Those two teams press really hard and are pretty good. So... Yeah. Real Madrid have experience of playing against teams that press significantly harder than this. So I think that's one issue. But the bigger issue is that Real Madrid don't care about possession.
No, not at all.
If you press Man City and you take the ball off them and then you hold the ball, because that's really what they don't want you to do. More than getting pressed, Man City don't want you to have the ball because Pep's Man City have slowly moved away from being an elite pressing side. They press less and less, you know, which I think is an interesting development. But like, their whole game, Arsenal's whole game, like loads of teams, their whole game is like, we have the ball. And if they don't have the ball, they're like, shit, what do we do? Real Madrid don't care at all. In the group stage, they had 50% of the ball against Napoli in one game and 53% in another. They had 52% and 48% in their games against Braga. They won all those games.
Yeah.
Against Man City, 39% and 33%. Like, they just don't care. And when you look at them, you know, even our preview when we talked about Real Madrid Man City, we were kind of like, well, the scenario in which Real Madrid win this game is they kind of like make things stodgy with their midfield talent and their defenders. Mm-hmm. And then they have like Toni Kroos hits Vinicius and Rodrigo on the break. That is what they do. And they just have that system. Like, if anything, they're better set up for that than they are for like structured possession. Yeah.
In many ways, if Dortmund were to play Man City, I think they could implement a more efficient or more effective game plan than they can against this Real Madrid team by disrupting possession. Because
like City plan A could work against City,
As in, like, we'll press them hard and really try and or press them like within reason hard and just try and like disrupt all of this possession that they want to have. Real Madrid, I don't really see how they can implement that effectively because Real Madrid can't just let them have the ball. At which point Dortmund will have to come forward anyway. And when Real Madrid are pressed, they are, like you say, they are good enough to get through your Bundesliga press. And I just I just do not see a way that Dortmund can implement, outside of like some footballing gods or getting footballed or whatever. I don't see how Dortmund can come in with like a fully coherent plan that they genuinely believe this could work. Like, if we play this game flat, this plan should or could work if it's implemented well. I just don't see that on the horizon for this game. And
I agree.
That doesn't mean they can't win it. Like, things happen in football all the time. Random goals happen. Just absolutely ridiculous special moments happen. But coming into this flat game, on paper, game plans, I really don't see how Dortmund can take anything based on how the two teams play and the quality within those squads. I just don't see how Dortmund can come into this game with a game plan that they can say, if we implement this well, we have a really good chance. Because I just don't see it.
Yeah, I think Real Madrid don't even really need to bother that much. Like, as in, Real Madrid, for example, if you were like Man City going into Dortmund game, you could say, well, let them press us. We believe that we're good enough to play through it. But you could also say, you know what? Let's surprise them. Mm. Let's switch it up and let's let them have the ball. And our defense is good enough to hold them at bay because their attack isn't all that. And then we'll hit them on the break and we'll destroy them. Like, you could do either one of those things. But I really don't think Real Madrid need to like think about it that deeply. Like, because one thing, and I know that people who are kind of critics of Ancelotti say this, so it sounds like a criticism, but it isn't. I do think Real Madrid manage themselves on the pitch better than any team in the world. Like, Real Madrid, I especially think about that game at Anfield. Was it last season? You know when they went, was it two goals down? mm-hmm. early on to Liverpool. Was that last year?
Was that last season? It must have been the year before. Was it?
No, it was still Benzema. I don't know. Anyway, they went down early on, and everyone was like, "This is going to be a beatdown." Like, it was scary. Like, Liverpool were all over them, and then at a certain point, Real Madrid just like got their foot on the ball, calmed down, started passing it around, had a bit of possession, kind of got lucky to get a goal to get back into it, then got another. Like, that was like kind of a great strike from Vinicius, I think. And by the end of the game, they were hooping. Like, they just absolutely like ripped through Liverpool by the end. And, you know, that was the game where Modric was like racing through midfield last minute. Mm-hmm. But like, it's almost like Real Madrid will just sort of, Real Madrid's players will look at the game and sort of work out what the game requires and then just start playing that way. And that really isn't to do down Ancelotti. Like, I love Ancelotti. I think he's amazing. But I sort of think that if Real Madrid are doing something in the final and it's not working, Ancelotti might change it. But equally, the players might just be like, huh, I guess we're going to have to do something else. And Toni Kroos will start hitting like long crossfield balls to Rodrigo. Or, oh, okay, their press isn't as good as we thought it was. Okay, we're going to pass it round at the back and draw them onto us, and then we'll just go through them quickly. Like, I think that Real Madrid are incredibly good. That I think insofar as, you know, they just have it when it gets to this stage of the Champions League. This is the closest I get to this, but I think this is more material than like it's voodoo. I just think Real Madrid read the game. They have so many highly experienced, super talented players who could play lots of different ways and who will just read the game and be like, we can just do something different.
Yeah, I think it's like with Real Madrid, historically, their teams have always had this air of arrogance about themselves where, one, they never really believe they'll lose a game. Even if they're coming up against a better team, they'll still have the arrogance of like, we'll win this game. And two, in the biggest moments, they don't hide. They're not scared, or generally they're not scared of these big moments. And when things are going bad, the wheels don't come off. My mind going straight back to that game. What was it? Yeah, the second leg, Bayern Arsenal. You know, obviously everybody was very highlighted Saka's movements in the very end of that game with the corner, with the quick free kick to Ben White. Those moments felt like a younger, inexperienced team that the occasion kind of muddied their decision making at points, because the magnitude of the event was so big that they were so desperate to get the win that they just didn't necessarily, they didn't have the calm presence of
you could just see the fear. You could see the fear on the pitch.
Whereas
like they were so desperate to score that they were like, let's just get it forward, really. Like, they had no, like, we've got 20 minutes, no worries, we'll be fine.
With Real Madrid, you don't see that, or you very, very rarely see that. They just have an arrogance and a self-belief and confidence in themselves that they'll be like, we're good enough to get back in this game, let's just play. Let's just do what we need to do, see where we end up.
Sure.
And I think because they're so established and they're so successful historically, they don't feel the need to prove themselves as much, I suppose. Arsenal, this current Arsenal squad, obviously still feel the need to prove themselves. They haven't won the Champions League in their history. They haven't won the Premier League in, 22 years? Once you remove that expectation, the need to prove yourself, or the feeling of needing to prove yourself, again, I imagine that comes easier, to be calm and be like, what will be, what will be. But yeah, with Madrid, I just think, even if things aren't going well for them, and I really, like I've said, I don't see how Dortmund can really cause many scenarios where Real Madrid will be thinking, this game is not going the way we want it to. But even if it does, there isn't another team on the planet that I would be like, you know what, they'll figure it out. And they'll turn the tides in their way somehow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So prediction is Real Madrid win comfortably?
Yeah, I mean, I think it could be quite a boring game, to be honest. I think, especially if Madrid score in the first like 25, 30 minutes, I think it's just a bit of a dead rubber at that point. I think like this could be 2-0, maybe 3-1.
I'd like Dortmund to come out and really try and spring a surprise. The problem is I just don't really think they have the personnel to like press at a high level anymore. They just certainly don't have the coach. But like, you know, it's not like Atletico Madrid, for example. People were talking about Atletico Madrid in the Champions League as if they were like the defensive powerhouse they've always been. They are not that anymore. They don't play that way, but they have enough of the same players and they have the same coach that you think they can probably do it if they need to. You know, if they got to a Champions League final and went a goal up, I'd be like, I'm pretty certain Atletico Madrid have got the muscle memory to like shithouse their way to the trophy.
Yeah, absolutely.
with Dortmund, I just don't think that's the case anymore. Like, it's been such a long time since they were a really top quality pressing side that I just don't really see them kind of pulling it together. But that's kind of the only way I could see it working, because I don't think they have the individual quality. It has to be a systemic thing.
Well, that's the thing. Like, when I'm looking at through this, I'm looking at Dortmund's squad or lineup for the PSG game, second leg, and I'm just not seeing a huge amount of names that I could be like, if somebody told me 2 weeks from now that this guy played lights out in the Champions League final and was the main reason that Dortmund won it, and I wouldn't be staggeringly shocked. I could see maybe Sancho doing something. Outside of that, you know, Adeyemi, maybe. You know, Sabitzer's playing DM for them. He's not going to do much.
Yeah.
Like, Füllkrug, Julian Brandt. It's like, you look through their squad, their starting squad as well.
Brandt's the other guy you could squint at and maybe see.
And add a push Adeyemi. He's been good this season. But, yeah, outside of maybe those 2.5 players, I just don't see a player that can really stand up and be counted and make the difference enough to knock Madrid off the pedestal. I just don't see it.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. It would be nice to get surprised, but it feels like it's not going to happen this year. So shall we move on to topic number 2? Okay, so big news coming out of Stamford Bridge this week. And honestly, like, you know, Chelsea doing radical stuff is not that surprising. But this did come as a surprise. Like, Mauricio Pochettino and Chelsea parting ways by quote-unquote mutual consent after less than 11 months, 51 games, of which he's won about half. Chelsea searching for a manager in what is probably, like, the most underpopulated and turbulent managerial market we've seen in years. It doesn't really seem like a great situation. I mean, Pete, like, what was your reaction to it? Were you as surprised as I was, I guess? Oh, and maybe did it worry you as a Man United fan that you were like, oh shit, we're gonna have to compete for a new coach with Chelsea?
So I actually didn't see the news until you messaged me when we were like doing prep for the pod. What should we talk about, etc., etc. And then he messaged me being like, have you seen the Poch news? We should probably talk about that. And I read that message and I was like, the Poch news? I wonder what that is. And there wasn't like a fibre of my being that thought he's been sacked. Parting by mutual consent. But there wasn't like a fibre of my being that was like, Pochettino news. Why could Pochettino be in the news right now? And me land on him leaving Chelsea. So I was 100% fully shocked by this move. I don't feel that threatened about competing with Chelsea as United, because one, I just think United's a more attractive job in many ways, and two, Pochettino is kind of the front runner for United at the minute anyway, or one of the front runners, so I could see that potentially happening. And I don't see, basically the two United managers that I would like the most are Pochettino and Tuchel. And I don't think either of them will... I don't think Chelsea are on the cards for either of them. One's just left and one left the guy before him.
yeah, actually, that's a good point.
So, like, and then outside of that, you're into, like, Kieran McKenna, who's kind of unproven as well. So it's like, I don't feel that threatened just because of the scenario that... like, the very specific scenario that United and Chelsea are in.
Mm-hmm.
And the history that Chelsea have. So, yeah, I was totally shocked. And initially I read it as, like, Pochettino has been sacked. And I think a lot of the narrative, certainly with like punters, is that Chelsea have sacked Pochettino. Chelsea should have given him more time, etc. It's all very much about Pochettino being removed from the club against his will. And usually when clubs say like managers left by mutual consent, it seems like a pseudo sacking. You know, it's like a kindly worded, we think you should stop doing your job at this club right now. And you're essentially being sacked. This, for me, kind of feels a bit different, because if it was a true sacking, I think it's kind of mental, because there isn't that much justification for sacking him, certainly when you look at just on-pitch stuff, because Chelsea are generally fine. Like, they've had a fairly respectable season. Like, it started very badly, but they finished sixth. If Man City win on Saturday at the FA Cup final, that I think is good enough for Europa League, because it means United won't take Europa League spots. So they finished in Europa League spots. And like I said, they had a horrible start to the season, but that's kind of understandable because Chelsea have been super unstable. They've got a super young squad that don't really know how to play together. They're changing managers at will. It's a very, very toxic scenario to come into for any manager. So to come in and be expected to hit the ground running immediately is virtually impossible. But by the end of the season, Chelsea started to look fairly decent. Like, if you take just from February 1st until the end of the season, if you do a league table from February 1st to now, Chelsea are third. Again, behind, obviously, Arsenal and City. But by the end of the season, they started to look like a genuinely cohesive and not necessarily a great team, but you could see progression under them. And like, if you look at them, obviously, it's easy to say, let's just take the good part of a season and forget about the bad part. This team is good. But even if you look at their season as a whole, their underlying numbers are all fairly positive. Because outside of Arsenal, City and Liverpool, the next team that has the highest XG diff per 90 this season are Chelsea. So Chelsea have a plus 0.43 XG diff per 90. Then there's a fairly big jump to Arsenal, City and Liverpool, who are all above plus 1.1. But realistically speaking, when Pochettino came into this job, and whatever Chelsea board, whatever Chelsea fans could expect from the season, at least in the short term, would be that Chelsea would become the best of the rest. Because they're not in a position right now to genuinely challenge Arsenal, City or Liverpool. They're just not as good as them. They might be in a few years. They genuinely could be. But this season and in the short term, realistically, the best thing that they could have hoped for is being the best of the rest. Now, looking at the table, like the actual table, technically that will be Aston Villa based on league position. But their underlying numbers suggest that they are the best of the rest of the Premier League. So as a first season under Poch, everything kind of seems generally fine on the pitch. And not only generally fine, like say Ten Hag, for example. I could see him being sacked very soon, but that's because United are clearly in regression. Whereas Chelsea, from the start of the season to now, you can see genuine progression within that squad. Not just in terms of like their underlying numbers and the points, but just like eye test. Like the team under Pochettino at the end was considerably better in performance than the team in his early months. And for me, that is more than enough to justify like not being sacked for on-pitch matters. Which makes me believe that, one, the mutual consent thing is true, that both parties genuinely didn't mind parting ways, and two, that most of the issue were generally things about behind the scenes. So The Athletic actually did a pretty decent article reporting kind of what their internal sources have told them were big points of contention between Pochettino and the kind of club's hierarchy, and they included things like Pochettino being expected to fit into a club imposed structure, which Pochettino historically doesn't necessarily love. He loves to be more autonomous and kind of have control. Things like Pochettino not being fully sold on a very, very expensive midfield pairing of Caicedo and Enzo. Chelsea also apparently want a coach who teaches quote-unquote football, and they don't believe that Pochettino has shown enough this season to prove that he is the right guy to nurture this super young but very, very talented but very, very raw squad over the next three seasons. And even if you look at like the starting off point with Chelsea and Poch, it was never great, at least looking at it retrospectively and in hindsight. Hindsight's never wrong, of course, but when you look at the fact that Pochettino wanted a three-year contract and Chelsea gave him a two-year contract with an optional 12-month extension, that doesn't seem like that significant. However, managers very, very, very rarely get to the last year of the contract. It's either they're sacked before that or they're renegotiated. So basically that means Pochettino was effectively put on a rolling contract, a season-by-season contract, because we get to this stage in the summer of his first season and he either, well, he's obviously parted ways, but then they would have either triggered the extension and then the season after that assessed whether they extend again or like negotiate a new contract or they part ways with him. So basically Pochettino was essentially effectively on a season-long rolling contract, which for a super young, super raw, super unproven squad that has had four permanent managers since we started this podcast, if you include Thomas Tuchel. Like the replacement, whoever comes in, say they replace in a few months.
My God, that's crazy.
That will be the fourth permanent manager, if you include Tuchel, that has happened since we started this podcast. And we're on the, I think this is episode 80 something, early 80s. We have not been going that long for Chelsea to have had four permanent managers. God, there's also so within crazy. That, two interim managers in Frank Lampard coming back and Bruno Saltor or something. I can't remember his name.
I don't know. We just call him like Bruno, don't we?
Yeah, he plays Bruno something. But yeah, so the entire toxic club that is Chelsea and the squad have just had an absolute merry-go-round for the past 2.5+ seasons. And even if you go back further than that, if you go back to Conte, they've had 7 permanent managers in less than 6 years.
Yeah.
Which is...
That is insane.
Not even just this current crop of super young, super unproven, super raw, talented players waiting to be moulded into a cohesive squad. If you go back further than that, it's still toxic. It's still a managerial merry-go-round. So for Poch, I kind of think his process or his thought process was, give me a few years to actually work with these guys, put some stability in the club, and we'll get where you want to be in a few seasons. Obviously, Chelsea's viewpoint is that we got burned by Potter. We gave him a 5-year contract and he lasted 30-something games. So you can see arguments from both sides, but from the very, very off, it just felt that Pochettino was never a long-term option, was barely even a mid-term option because of the fact that he's effectively been put on a rolling contract. And I just feel that was never really going to work that well with this type of squad because of how much work this squad needs over a number of years. These players have the ability to be very, very good, but they do not have the ability to be like incredibly good right now. And to become very good in a very good squad, they need a manager that they're bought into, both squad and club, that can grow with this squad.
But this and is where...
It's strange that... Well, I can't say I'm massively shocked that this wasn't a fully successful endeavour given the parameters of the squad and how Pochettino never felt like an actual long-term employment option.
That's true. I think, though, what's strange to me is that Chelsea didn't think, oh, we need to hitch our wagon to him. Like, because when they hired him, their theory should have been, this has to be the guy. And now, even more so. So when you say, like, I think that, you know, both parties were okay with it, I think, yeah, they probably were. I think Pochettino's got some of his payout and he gets out of this situation, which is, to be honest, like, quite scary and stressful. And to be honest with you, I sort of think that Gallagher might be it. I think Gallagher might be the issue, where Chelsea have said, we're selling Conor Gallagher, and Poch has said, don't. I really want him in my midfield. He's one of the few things that's worked for me this season. And they've said, sorry, it's what's happening. And he's like, okay, I'm annoyed. Like, to me, when they talk about like the club, he doesn't fit into the club imposed structure. What I'm hearing is, he doesn't agree with the decisions that we're making, like, without him.
Yeah,
exactly. So, but it's weird to me that Chelsea didn't say, no, we have to keep you. Because I talked about this a bit with Zach actually today, but Chelsea have to get Champions League football next year. For their finances, it has to happen. Like, they are in so much trouble with PSR if they don't get an enormous influx of cash from the Champions League, basically. It's really kind of the only way to get it. And I think that is why you're at the moment seeing them somehow add to their huge debt by going out and signing, you know, Willian Estevao. Like, they're going and getting these guys. I think because their theory is, it doesn't matter how big the pile is, you know, of like debts we have to pay off. What we have to do it remains the same, which is get back in the Champions League, get a huge amount of like revenue coming into the club. Because
basically,
we can't
they need
just
to win the Europa
pumping.
League then, next season.
Yeah, like they have to. Man City really need to like win that final and put them in the Europa League. And then they probably need to get as much money as they can from the Europa League. And also, Europa League is quite helpful for them for developing their youngsters. And then they need to get in the Champions League. And so,
I would have
whoever
more faith
comes
in winning
into
Europa League than finishing fourth.
Yeah, well, yeah. But whoever comes in is basically going to be told it's not okay to finish sixth this year.
Yeah,
it's not. It's not okay to say this is a project. This is a win now situation. You need to get in the Champions League places. But they don't really have the money to go out and go, and they don't, and also, you know, they've kind of burnt through them, but they don't really have the money to go and get like Tuchel back or something and be like, please just give us a year and like fix this for us. So their theory should have been, let's keep Pochettino, because what they're looking at now is a bargain option. Now, that's not to say that like McKenna or someone isn't great. Like, he might be he might be end up being the best manager in the world for all I know. Like, I don't know. So might Seb Hernes. So might like any of these guys they're looking at, though not De Zerbi and not Frank, as much as I like both those guys. But they might have a difficult transition year, or they might not be there yet in their development. And they might be like, well, my system works in the Championship, but it doesn't actually work against Arteta and Guardiola and Arne Slot and Eddie Howe and all the other like good managers in the Premier League. I've never managed against a league where almost every team has a good coach.
Yeah.
Like that is a new thing. Like West Ham are managed by Lopetegui. Palace are managed by Glasner. Like this is a tough league. That is a huge ask for a guy coming up from the Championship. And I just kind of think like Chelsea's best bet at progress, at keeping the squad together, at winning the Europa League or getting in the Champions League places next year was keeping Pochettino. They should have done everything possible to do it,
yeah.
Unless they had someone up their sleeve like, oh, well, you know, somebody like Tuchel, basically, you know, like some firefighter,
yeah,
who could just come in and like squeeze everything out of them to get them up to fourth. You know, like when Zidane went back to Real Madrid, mm, and it, yeah, was just like Zidane will just like make it happen.
Like Ancelotti, like, when he won the first Champions League, yeah, his first season.
If Ancelotti was sitting out there like unemployed, you'd be like, you'd go, yeah, to Ancelotti and you'd be like, we will give you anything it takes.
Yeah.
Just please cobble together a working side.
This is what we have. Make it work.
Get us in the top four or five. It might be five, you know, like just get us in the Champions League spots because that's what we need. So I don't know. I find it absolutely insane that Chelsea were not like, this is a catastrophic problem, because like maybe Pochettino wouldn't have progressed. And I do think that the end of the season looked better than it was. Though overall, I agree with you. You know, like their numbers across the season are better than people think.
Yeah.
I think the end of the season, those results are better than their underlying numbers were in those games.
Yeah, I still think they've progressed. I still think the trend is up.
Okay, sure. But I guess it's more that I just look at those games at the end of the season and it's not like, well, if the season had gone on another month, where would they have been? It's like, if the season had gone on another month, it's likely that their results would have regressed to their underlying numbers and they would have finished exactly where they were, in, yeah, my opinion.
Yeah, I think
because
that's
they
fair.
Weren't really the better side against Brighton or Bournemouth.
No, I think that's
they
fair. But my point was more that if you look at the season as a whole, if the season was a graph in terms of quality and performance, it would be trending upwards.
Yeah.
From the start of the season to when the end of the season. It's a general trend.
And I'm saying I'm not fully sold on that.
You think they've not progressed this season as a squad?
I don't know, but like their performances at the end of the season, I did not think were much better than their performances had been the whole season.
Mm.
And when you think about like statement performances they had, a lot of those came earlier in the year. You know, like games where, okay, they had the West Ham game where they really battered West Ham.
Yeah.
But when you look at games they had like earlier in the season, like games where they actually went toe-to-toe with a really good opponent, like Arsenal, like City, where they played really, really well.
Yeah.
Those were much earlier in the year. I don't know. It's fine. Like it's not really the issue. It's more just that I think like we're agreeing in the sense that the best way to start an upward trajectory, in my view, or continue an upward trajectory, in your view, was to keep Pochettino.
Yeah.
And now they're in this situation where they're like, let's hope something changes. Like this idea that Poch's training methods have been the cause of all these injuries, I think is like deeply flawed reasoning. Like Chilwell, James, Nkunku, Fofana, these guys have been injury prone their whole careers. Lavia, okay, sure, don't really know, he's a kid. Yeah, they lost a lot of days to injury, but lots of teams did. And next season, the fixture congestion is going to be nuts. Zach pointed out to me today that there's the Club World Cup, which Chelsea have to play in.
And
because they won the Champions League. Like, yeah, there's the Euros
as
well.
There's no layoff for a lot of clubs.
It's going to be a grueling season. And I don't think, and there's no prospect that these injury issues will necessarily get any better. I think, yeah, you have a lot of injury prone players, and you might get lucky and Reece James is fit all year, and honestly that would make a huge, if Reece James and Nkunku were fit all year, that would make such a big difference to Chelsea. But
yeah,
I don't think whether they are or not has anything to do with Pochettino, and I think it's, I don't know, like those are injury prone guys, like, yeah, it's just like what their careers look like.
I think it's just unfortunate time. I think mostly it's down to just misfortune, bad fortune, in that this season happens to be probably the worst injury season Chelsea's ever had in the Premier League in terms of like days missed collectively across the club. And it also happens to be the first season that Pochettino's come in and overhauled the medical staff. So people drawing parallels between the two are to be expected. But yeah, I think it's a lot, you're clutching at straws there. This is just a thing that happens in football. I don't think Pochettino's like reportedly very intense sessions sort of a significant influence on the fact that they have had such a big injury list this season. I think it's,
yeah,
you're trying to find something where there's nothing really.
especially because loads of teams had really big injury problems this season. Like, okay, you could argue that Newcastle and Liverpool are some of the more intense sides in the league, but I don't think Spurs really are in particular. Like, I don't think, you know, there's not enough data for you to be able to establish a correlation in this situation. So that just reads like bullshit. Like, well, we kind of needed to have a dossier for, like, if we're going to get rid of Poch, here are all the reasons that we can put on the table. And Poch was probably like, I actually am fine with going because there are a bunch of managerial opportunities available this summer and you're going to give me some money to go away. And this is a fucking poison chalice.
This is where I have a little bit of a theory. So I think Pochettino was kind of, not done at Chelsea, but he was certainly frustrated and annoyed. He kind of felt that his wings were being clipped. Obviously, the club wanted to go in a direction that they just wanted him to say yes to. Like you mentioned Gallagher there, like, he's reportedly not necessarily sold on Enzo and Caicedo as a pairing. Gallagher was his guy this season. Gallagher played the most minutes in Chelsea's squad. And it's probably going to be sold because he's a pure profit deal and Chelsea need money. Just another thing that Pochettino's going to be frustrated about, being like, I want to keep him, you're going to sell him. Getting criticised and blamed for all of these injuries when he's pretty much got very, very little blame should be attributed to him. It's just a misfortune. All of these things kind of snowball into just a very, just not a very pleasant scenario for him to be in terms of his, like, job satisfaction. And then there's a reasonably big club a little bit further north, about 2.5 hours in the train further north of London, that have been reportedly interested in Pochettino before, big long-term admirers of him. And I find it quite interesting that Pochettino would have been so pissed off with Chelsea to leave by mutual consent and, like, forfeit probably what is quite a lot of money that he would have got paid out if he had made Chelsea sack him. But what, for me, what might sweeten that deal a little bit, what might make that loss of earning or loss of payout a little bit more palatable, would be a phone call from Sir Jim Ratcliffe saying, come to Manchester United and we will give you lots of money and a 3 or 4 year contract, and come and fix us and we'll be a much less toxic and we will give you much more influence and we're just a bigger club as well. My conspiracy theory is that is why he accepted a mutual termination. Chelsea wanted a mutual termination because obviously they clearly have made that decision, and that whether that's right or wrong, we probably both agree that it is a wrong decision, and it's actually a very, very unstable decision in a very, very integral and important season coming up for them in terms of their finances and whatnot. So they clearly made the decision that they weren't going to continue with him, but they also can't afford to sack him because their finances are fucked. So it works for them. Pochettino, if Man United came in and were like, accept the mutual termination, just get out of there, come to us, I can see a world where that is a decent factor in Pochettino saying, you know what, right, yeah, let's part ways. That's my thinking anyway.
Okay, I think that's fair enough. Like, I mean, and plus, you know, you look at United and you're like, if Chelsea are basically saying you have to get top four next year, and United are saying, but also we don't know if we're going to have any money to spend. Like, if we spend any money, it's going to be on, like, the youngsters we've identified. We're not going to get you the experienced players that you want. We're not going to replace, like, Thiago Silva, like for like, insofar as there is a like for like. Whereas United are saying, you can spend a bunch of money here over the next few years. You already know a couple of our players. Like, he coached Eriksen. He coached Luke Shaw, right? He must have done. There are a couple of Argentinians, actually, as well, now I think about it. You know, a couple of significant Argentinians in the squad. But, like, it is more of a project, but there's going to be more money, and we are just going to, like, we're basically, like, turning over a new leaf, and it's not going to be a new manager every couple of years. We will give you your 3-year contract.
Yeah.
And, you know, really build something special. And you'd kind of look at the squad and you'd be like, that squad is better than its position in the table. Like, its position in the table is dog shit. Its play is even worse.
But also, the squad was more money.
I'd also be like, Bruno, Garnacho, Hoyland, even Sancho potentially, like Lisandro Martinez, sure. Like, I would look at that and I'd be like, well, I need like 5 or 6 new first teamers, but I've then kind of got a team.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Whereas with Chelsea, I'd be like, something can be built, but I don't get to build it. And they're just going to do what they want. And they're going to say, like, here are a bunch of other fucking kids, like, see what you could do with them. So, I mean, it feels like the McKenna thing is kind of going to happen. I mean, I don't know if you have a take on him. I don't really, because I also don't really think it matters. I think it doesn't matter how how great you think he is,
yeah,
it's still an enormous risk.
Huge.
And he doesn't give you any more certainty of getting the one thing that matters to you next season, which is by hook or crook getting into the Champions League. So that's one of those things. It's not like, you know, when Liverpool like sacked Brendan Rodgers because they were like, we've seen an opportunity to get Jurgen Klopp, so we've got to do it. Mm-hmm. Like, that made sense. That made sense. Whereas with McKenna, you're not like, McKenna might be one of the best managers of his generation, but like, even if he is, Chelsea aren't really in that position where they can find out. Like, Chelsea need a guy, like Chelsea need like Antonio Conte or someone who's just going to come in and be like, I'm going to shout at everyone for a year. And I'm going to bully you all, and you're going to hate me,
but we're going to finish fourth.
But we're going to win 25 games, and we're going to, like, you know, be like, shockingly good.
This this season's a real bird in the hand, is two in the bush for Chelsea. Like, and McKenna is two in the bush. He is very unproven. Like, he does seem to have very good attributes, and he seems like he could become a very, very good top level manager. But he's 38. He was born in 1986, Patrick. He's what? 2 years older than you, and
three years older than you. Shut the fuck up.
I'm aging you.
I'm 34. I am 35 this year.
But you look 30, according to most of the guests at my wedding. You've told me.
Well, according to a couple of guys at your wedding.
But he's very unproven. He's very young, and he's never managed at the top level before. And even outside of that, Ipswich was his first senior managerial role. Before that, he was at Tottenham under 18s, then he was at United under 18s, then he was in the coaching staff for a handful of seasons under a couple of managers at United. I think he left when Ragnick left. But around that time, there is so much uncertainty about how he will be able to kind of make that jump into the Premier. I think making that jump is difficult anyway. Never mind making it into a team that is very, very unstable, but also a team that is very unstable and also has very, very lofty and necessary expectations to meet from the off. So I think it's a big risk. I think looking at what he's done at Ipswich, it's very impressive. Back-to-back promotions is no mean feat. I think it's only the fourth time somebody's done it in the Premier League era. And yeah, like, he came into Ipswich, his first senior managerial role, and he made Ipswich a lot better fairly, fairly quickly. You know, since he came in, Ipswich XG went up significantly. Their expected goals against went down significantly. Last season, Ipswich were second in the league in expected goals against, fourth in XG diff per 90, first in shots per 90, third for passive per defensive action, and third for shots against per 90. So basically, that tells me it's a decent press that doesn't give up a lot of chances and is a pretty good attack. It gets a lot of shots. So, like, his press is fairly effective because it's not leaving them very, very vulnerable. And this is a team that was, like, mid-table the season and a half before they got promoted in the league below. Like, they were mid-table League One a season and a half before they got promoted. And, yeah, so basically his press is decent and it doesn't leave them super vulnerable.
And also, it's not like this happened as well, like, with a huge influx of cash. You know, like, there are teams who do something like that, like, go from being middling in one league to being good in the next through just, like, loads and loads of money. But that isn't the case. They've got a middling budget. Yeah.
Because, see, he's actually this season competing against parachute payment clubs like Leeds and Southampton,
who
he finished above. Obviously, Leicester were also a parachute payment club, but they finished above them. But he's actually competing against clubs with a lot more money. So, good press that isn't leaving them super vulnerable at the back. Good attack that is generating a lot of shots and a very healthy amount of XG and very, very highly placed in terms of, like, your XG diff per 90 metric in a league that they've just entered. So all of that is very, very positive for a guy who can play, like, good, attractive, expansive football with a decent pressing system that doesn't leave them fully vulnerable at the back. But we have no idea how that works in the Premier League.
Yeah.
We know it works in League One and the Championship. We know he can do it on a bit of a shoestring budget compared to some of the other clubs in the Championship that have a lot more money and a lot more resources. But the jump between the Championship and the Premier League, and especially the top half of the Premier League, is quite large. And this is a guy who is coming into his third, maybe fourth season as a senior manager in football. It's a big ask. It's a really big ask. And like you say, he could be our generation's Pep. He could be that.
Yeah.
He might turn into that. We do not know that. We have no idea if he is that. And also, if he is that, it'll likely take him 10 years to get there. Chelsea do not have that length of string. Chelsea do not have that time. Chelsea need a manager to come in and be pretty good from the off. And this is a risk.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a big ask. And the thing is, if Chelsea come knocking for Kieran McKenna, he cannot turn that down. Apparently, he's refused to open talks with Ipswich over contract extension. I think I read today that they've offered him like four times his salary to stay, whatever, whether that's true or not, who knows. But I believe he's not interested in opening renewal talks with Ipswich, which means he's going to go somewhere.
But I think he thought the somewhere was going to be like Brighton.
Yeah.
And now the somewhere is like Chelsea or Man United.
But the thing
maybe.
Is, Brighton would have been a completely manageable jump, I think. He would have been able to like, keep them up and keep them at least competitive and around the middle of the table. I think for a first season of a manager of that like ilk, and because if you're Brighton, you hire him for a number of seasons. You're not hiring him for like a temporary job. This is like, we're getting in early with you and we're going to develop with you. So as long as he doesn't have a catastrophic season, they stay up and they're pretty respectable. That jump from Ipswich to Brighton is manageable. The jump and in expectation as well from Ipswich to Chelsea is staggering. I think actually if he goes to United, that's an easier jump because United have less expectation on them. United can be have another couple of seasons where they're finishing like between 10th and 6th and being like, you know what, it's a longer project now, we get it. And it could work better now. United aren't under the same time constraints as Chelsea are. Nor do they have like the ridiculous contracts that Chelsea are subjected to for the next fucking eternity. So I think in many ways, the United job would be an easier transition, albeit still very, very large jump. But yeah, this Chelsea one's just... If Chelsea offer him the job, he can't say no. Like he just doesn't. He cannot say no. But I think it's very, very difficult for him to succeed.
I think if they said you have to finish top four, I'd say no.
You would say no, or do you think Kieran McKenna would say no?
I think it depends how he analyses the squad. Like, if he looks at the squad and he's like, a load of these players are going to be a year older, they're going to know each other better. You know, Nicholas Jackson's not going to miss chances at the rate he did last season. And Nkunku's probably back fit. Reece James is going to play more than he did. Like, that's enough. I would look at that and I'd be like, that probably is enough. Like, if you told me, if you offered me the Chelsea job and you could see into the future and you were like, Reece James will play, you know, 25 90s next season, then I'd be like, we'll be fine. That is enough of a difference. But if I looked at the squad and I was just like this requires a more sophisticated eye than I have. This is like a real coach's eye.
Yeah.
Like, if I looked at the squad and I was like, I don't have the pieces I need to play the way I want to play. They're not going to give me the other pieces I need.
Or the time.
I'm not going to... Yeah, and you're telling me I need to finish top four this season. If I looked at it and I was like, I'm not sure I can do it, then I'd... Like, unless I was absolutely sure I could do it, basically, I'd be like, no, it's not worth it. Because then you end up in the Potter situation where they're like, well, he failed at Chelsea. Like, if Potter hadn't taken that Chelsea job, he might be like Spurs manager now.
Yeah.
And I just think that that's kind of like a bit of a miserable situation. So if I were McKenna, I'd be like, I know that everyone's like, you have to back yourself, but you have to back yourself. Like,
you can back yourself in a different way.
But you don't back yourself in poker by like going all in on every hand. You back yourself by knowing when to bet and when not.
Yeah.
And so if I were McKenna, I'd be like, I want a really good look at this squad. Yeah. And if it's not,
fair point.
If there's something in it that's giving me pause for thought, I'm just not going to take this job because it's not going to hurt me. Because even if he stayed at
Ipswich, that's a bigger bet. That's a ballsier move.
If he stayed at Ipswich and Ipswich got relegated, I don't think it would hurt his reputation. No. Maybe very slightly.
I think it's a ballsier move to turn down this job and say, you know what, I'll be able to get a similar job next year or the year after that than it would be to take it.
And I think not only would he be able to get a similar job next year or the year after, I think he'd be able to get a job with more security. Like, it would not be surprising, for example, if this next Liverpool managerial stint is only a couple of years. It would not be surprising if Man United don't, like, get the right guy straight away. It would not be surprising if Chelsea hire a guy and after a year are like, we need to hire another guy. Like, it would not be surprising, like, if Bayern Munich are like, you know what, like, company hasn't worked out. And so they go and pilfer a manager from another team. And then that team is like, well, what about Kieran McKenna? Like,
there are Pep's all probably sorts... going to step down at some point soon as well. So there'll be a big hole to fill there. Not for him necessarily, but it could open up a hole somewhere else in a good team.
There are all sorts of jobs that could become available. And if I were McKenna, I'd be like, I will learn from Potter in the sense that I'm
cautionary
not...
Tale, yeah.
Potter jumped into a much better situation. It was a more settled team. It was a team that had just won the Champions League. They already played in a system that should have suited him. Like, and it was an absolute disaster. Like, but and that was way better set up. Like, McKenna is jumping into a team that is significantly worse with some players who I think are just going to be like a drain on resources, who will probably never be much of anything. Yeah. Like, is Mudryk ever going to be much of anything?
He's going to be fast.
I don't really know.
But
maybe, yeah. So I don't know.
If McKenna turned to Dine, then who?
Well, Zach and I talked about this today. I think that obviously your best case scenario, but you don't really have the money, would be someone like Inzaghi. Mm. But I doubt he speaks English. And I really do think you need someone to hit the ground running. Obviously, I'd have kept Poch. The guy I settled on was, if you can't get any of the major players who are knocking around, just go and get like Nagelsmann or something and accept that he's going to be at the Euros.
Mm.
Because I do think he's a much more proven quantity.
Entry, yeah.
Than some of these guys. But failing that, if you can't get a proven guy, then do take a gamble. And take a gamble on someone you don't know, like McKenna. It's better to gamble on McKenna than go and get someone like De Zerbi, I think. Because I don't know whether McKenna is like a generational talent as a manager. I don't know whether McKenna is just like capable of pulling this all together. But I do feel fairly certain that De Zerbi is not. Like, De Zerbi, like... No, De Zerbi, I think, is a really good manager, but De Zerbi is not like a once in a generation talent.
He's not without his limitations.
Yeah, exactly. Like, so it's better to get a guy who might be a C but might be an A than it is to get someone who's just a B when you're in Chelsea's position. They need more than that. They need more than a B. Anyway, it's funny. It's funny to see Chelsea like be crap. Like, I love it. And honestly, I hope we're in the same situation in a year's time. But they've been relegated, and Man City are having a great time in the Championship, 25-26.
Man City will be in the National League next season.
Okay. We joke about this, but that is actually what should happen.
Have you seen their odds for relegation next season? Or 25-1 now?
Oh, pretty good. Yeah. Honestly, though, like, it is crazy to me that when people talk about this, there's any debate. Or that people are just like, well, you know, we'll wait and see. It's like, no. Like, we know they did all this.
Yeah, it's basically what can you prove?
We've read the emails where they say stuff like, can you please send us that? When the owner sends us money, can he send it marked like Etihad, rather than marked Sheikh Mansour's fucking rainy day fund?
Yeah.
Like, it's so hilariously transparent. Like, but everyone's just like, oh no, Man City, like, we can't say anything, you know, until the case has happened. I honestly think I'm hoping that because the league is scared of the government stepping in and like regulating them, that they'll be like, we need to like show that we can regulate ourselves, and that they do something punitive, because this isn't just like my Arsenal like fan hat on. Like, I do think it like compromises the integrity of the league.
I think,
like,
absolutely,
they've cheated. You're not allowed to cheat.
Yeah,
like, it doesn't matter that they've played great football and that Pep's the best manager and half their players are incredible. Like, they are. They've played great football. Like, they've been the better team, like, in pretty much every season they've won the league, except this one. But, like, that doesn't matter. You're not allowed to cheat.
Yeah.
Like, anyway, we'll see. We'll see what gets shown to be the case. But based on the evidence I've seen, that is my feeling. Shall we move on to the burn book? All right, burn book time. What are you putting in the burn book this week, Pete? Give it to me.
Okay, what I'm putting in the burn book, I imagine you'll have a pretty significant opinion on this as a father.
Okay.
What I'm putting in the burn book this week are fashionable children. And when I mean fashionable children, I mean children who are like 6 and under. The ones you see who are like walking about in Yeezy foam slides, whatever's in fashion currently for like adults, these children are dressed in it. And it just really, it never sits right with me, because I look at them and I'm like, objectively, that is very cute because it's just a small version of a fashionable person. But that child has in no way any interest in what they're wearing. That is all like a projection from the parents. And the parents want to dress them up and be really like fashionable, and they think it's really like cool if they'll match their outfits together, like the mum's outfit matches the daughter or son's outfit, and they're both really fashionable and influential in that. You cannot tell me that any child in the world will prefer to be dressed like that than to be wearing like some ridiculous like princess dress, or be dressed as Spider-Man, or like a fucking dinosaur, or like have some like cartoon on their shirt that completely is not fashionable, but it's fun. And that is what children should be having, fun. Your kid is not a fashion accessory. It's not like an extension. It's not like a handbag. It's not like a Birkin. It's not like you, it's not an extension of your fashion or your style. It's a kid. Like, let them be a kid. That you have a very, very small time to enjoy life as a child. Let them just, if they want to dress up as like Superman, let them dress up as Superman. If they want to dress themselves and they look ridiculous but they're clothed, who cares? They're having fun. They do not need to be wearing the latest fashion trends. They definitely don't need to be wearing like designer clothes. Buying designer like shoes or like whatever for a kid that's 2 years old that will grow out of them in 6 months. Nonsense. It's like, your kid is not a fashion item. Your kid is not an accessory. Just let them be a kid. So anytime I see it, I'm like, I know that the kid never chose to wear this. Like, it would be different if the kid wakes up and is like, you know what I want to wear today? I want to wear Dolce & Gabbana and Balenciaga, please. If you show me a kid that does that and says that and isn't influenced massively and entirely by their parents, then I'll eat my hat and be like, you know what? Fair enough, I was wrong. But I think if you lay out two outfits and one was like a fucking dinosaur outfit or a superhero outfit or a princess outfit, and the other one was like whatever is the latest trend, 10 out of 10 kids choose the princess, dinosaur, Superman costume. And there's just no way they don't, in my opinion.
That's true. My daughter is currently insisting on wearing this Rapunzel.
Yeah, I've seen them. Yeah.
Dress, which I absolutely despise.
Do you not like it?
It's so ugly. And it's, well, the bigger issue is that she like hates to take it off like when it's time for bed and stuff. And so it's a fight all the time. And okay. I'm like, if she just liked it slightly less,
it would be easier.
That would be very helpful. I mean, the thing itself is also really ugly. And then like the other day we had such a fight about it that she had to go down for her like lunchtime nap wearing it. And it's like obviously made of like polyester. And I was like, this is too hot for you to sleep in. Like it's not, it's just not good for you. So that's something that I don't really like about it. But I mean, my bigger issue, I think, related to this is, or rather an issue related to this, is that I quite often see people putting their children... It's one thing to be like, my kid has to wear a t-shirt. I want them to wear a Balenciaga t-shirt. So that's the t-shirt they're going to wear. I mean, I think that's gross. And I think that they always buy the shittiest things from these brands. Like, it's never like good stuff from the brand. It's the stuff that says the name of the brand prominently, right? That's the point. My bigger issue is when it's like uncomfortable like leather shoes. Like I know people who put their kids in, especially shoes it is in particular, that are clearly not comfortable, like not made for children. They're miniaturized version of adult shoes, like leather boots, for example. And you're like, that's not good for a child. A child needs like soft, like quite soft but supportive shoes that let their foot have its natural shape. Because they're not good at maintaining their balance, their bones are still developing, like everything is still like kind of in flux. If you're putting your child in like shoes that are not good for their development just because you think they're cute, like you're actually being an arsehole. Like you're kind of harming your child rather than just being like, well, I'm just like a stupid, like money-grabbing little whore.
I think it's totally fine to dress your kid in like cute outfits that are child appropriate. Like the clothes are made for children of that age. I'm not disputing that. It's the fact is that most of the fashion trends that I see, because also it's like it's only really visible when it's really visible, if that makes sense. Like when you really notice somebody's trying really hard to make their kid like a fashion statement, and those kids are those fashionable items are made for adults, and that's the problem I have. It's just like nonsense.
Agreed. Nonsense. I think it's gross. I don't hate it as much as like we've talked about this before, but you know, the putting a kid in like a flat cap or something like that to me is like true. That to me is truly evil, because flat caps should not exist. We should treat flat caps like Nazi uniforms. Like that's how unwelcome they should be in civilized society. But anyway, I agree. You're right. What I'm putting in the burn book, coming to it quite late, but I felt like it was time. I do not want people who don't listen to hip hop talking to me about the Drake Kendrick beef. I don't need that. I'm in some WhatsApp groups where recently some white people have had some thoughts about Drake and Kendrick. And like, I listen to a lot of hip hop. I've listened to hip hop my whole life. I don't consider myself particularly current on it because, like, I listen to the stuff I grew up listening to, you know? But I listen to Kendrick. I don't really listen to Drake. But I don't feel the need to give people my opinion about it, partially because there is no real opinion to be had about it. But it's weird to me that a bunch of people who don't really take any interest in hip-hop most of the time have decided that now they have really strong opinions about Drake and Kendrick. And their opinions are so basic and stupid. Like, I just don't... More importantly, it's just like, this doesn't need you. Like, I'm sorry, this is the world's most boring beef. Despite how insane
I know there is beef, but I'm actually not familiar with what the beef is. Do you have a sentence to explain what the beef is?
Do I have a sentence? Let me try. Or is it too
complicated?
No, it's not. It's not complicated. I'm just trying to, like, basically, Drake has historically implied that he is at or above Kendrick's level, kind of like that he's kind of at his level as an artist, and that he's above his level as like a sort of, I guess, as a success, as a sort of cultural figure.
Yeah.
And Kendrick is like, no, you're not. And it really is kind of that. Like, I mean, like, there's other stuff rolled into it. Yeah, there's other stuff rolled into it, but it's like, you know, one person says something punchy, another person says something back, and it's slowly developed over time.
Yeah.
But it's just not very interesting because it's a beef between one guy who is one of the best working rappers alive and like one of the defining musicians of his generation, and another guy who makes like club bangers for baddies. Like, that is what it is. Like, that, which is fine. Look, like, it's fine. I mean, actually, in lots of ways, you can argue Drake is more influential. But, like, it is a fight between, like, you know, a professional... It's like Floyd Mayweather, like, fighting... I'm trying to think of somebody who, like, pretends to fight... Like a Power Ranger. Like a guy who... Not a real Power Ranger, but a guy who plays a Power Ranger.
Yeah. You know, where he'd be like... Whatever actor played the Red Ranger... Him.
Yeah, he'd be like, I pretend to fight for a living, and you're like, I really fight for a living. Like, okay. Like, but anyway, that's not my point. Like, I don't need to hear people's opinions about it. And a bunch of people are just like, oh my God, have you heard this song? Like, it's devastating, like, whatever. It's just like, oh my God, can't believe this is happening. It's like, stop going on about it. Like, pay attention to hip hop the rest of the time. And there's a bunch of stuff that's been going around about this as well, where people are like, I don't actually listen to a lot of hip hop, but like, this beef that's happening right now is so crazy, everyone. You know, like, these fucking TikTok videos are just like people who are like, oh my God, like, I stopped listening to like the stuff I normally listen to, and like, I couldn't believe that like hip hop, like, a load of them were like listening to Kendrick, and they were like, they couldn't believe that hip hop was good, basically. But I don't know, every opinion I've heard on it has just made me want to like punch the person having that opinion in the face. Like, nobody has added anything to my understanding of the situation. Like, it's not very interesting.
Is it really that deep? Is it really like that important of a beef?
No. Well, I don't know. Like, I mean, it is like...
Because I feel
It is pretty enormous, because it is like... It's basically like somebody who is as credible as they could be versus somebody who is like at the top of the sport, as it were, like as a kind of like financial... It's in that sense, it is like...
I get that, but I feel
it's
that...
not even like Nas, Jay-Z, because Jay-Z was more legit. It's more like... And it's not like cannabis, like LL Cool J. I don't know. I don't know if there's a good analogy for it.
It just feels that, like, I know very, very little about the inner workings of, like, the hip-hop hierarchy. Well, at least in terms of, like, enough to navigate this beef. But it feels like there are a lot of beefs that happen in hip-hop that end up in, like, someone genuinely dying. This does not feel anywhere near that, or it will ever get to that. This just feels like some people are being like, I think I'm better than you, and the other person being like, bro, you're not. Yeah. And that's pretty much it.
And one of the guys saying I'm better than you is like a guy from Canada who started out on like a children's like a teen
what was that called?
Teen drama. Degrassi.
Yeah.
And then there's another guy who's from Compton.
Sure. Yeah.
Like that is the beef.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. Anyway, every time so many people are just like, oh my God, like, this is crazy. Have you heard this? And it's people I know who I love, but like, some of them I'm just like, you went to private school, stop talking to me about fucking Kendrick.
It feels like somebody who objectively has like terrible fashion turns to somebody who has good fashion and says, you know, actually, I don't really like your top. If you were the person with good fashion, like, you'd be like,
or they're like,
cool, I don't care.
Or they're like, oh my God, like, what, you're not wearing like Sambas? Like, Sambas are like the cool shoe right now, or whatever, bro. And you'd be like, I'm wearing like Gats, like shut the fuck up. Like you know, it's like that sort of conversation where you're like, you've now got, they're at the beginning of the Dunning-Kruger thing, you know, where they've got that first little bit of knowledge and they don't yet know how ignorant they are. So they're just like, I feel like I've got an insight that nobody has ever had before into this art form that's now been around for like 50 years and is like tied up in a lot of very important cultural factors. And then like, you know, if they listen to hip hop for like another year, they'll be like, oh my God, I'm so ashamed I ever said anything publicly about this. Anyway, we're going very slowly. Let's move on to what we're taking out of the burn book.
Okay, I can be quick with this one, but what I'm taking out of the burn book is long form improvised comedy. Quite niche and probably
you're
a little
taking
bit,
this out of the burn
I'm taking
book.
This out of the burn book. So are you familiar with Ben Schwartz?
Yeah, I've seen the ones with him and Thomas Middleditch.
So Ben Schwartz, otherwise maybe most well known for being John Lothio in Parks and Recreation, American comedian.
One of the defining performances
of
our
unbelievable.
Generation.
But, like you say, he had a Netflix special, which is a long-form improvised comedy with his mate, is it Tom Middleditch?
Thomas Middleditch.
So basically what they do is they turn up on stage with essentially nothing planned, get stories from the audience in like really granular detail, and then do like a 70-minute sketch show about the information they're given from the crowd. He basically did the same thing, but without Tom Middleditch. So it was Schwartz and friends. It was him and three other actors. And they performed at the Royal Albert Hall on Sunday. Jess and I went. And obviously I'd watched the Middleditch and Schwartz specials and was like, this is great. Loved it. Like, it was really funny. And I don't know if this was better, but it was just delightful. Like, honestly, I think I laughed more at that than I've laughed at stand-up comedy. And I also love stand-up comedy. But, or at least that I laughed more frequently and harder at it. It was just, one, it was really funny, and two, it was really, really impressive. Obviously, like, they work together a lot. They're doing a tour, world tour and stuff. These four actors work together a ton, and I don't believe that it's, like, fully, fully improvised. You know, there'll be, like, kind of preset scenes that they can manipulate regardless of, like, they can interchange components in certain, like, sections of the show, if you know what I mean. They're able to get to stages where they're like, oh yeah, we've done something similar to this before, so then they kind of roll in a similar way. I feel that it's not like purely, fully, totally improvised, but it kind of pretty much is. And if you've ever like gone up on stage or spoken in front of like a large group of people and not had something like planned, you just like been thrown like a curveball, being like, oh, can you like introduce this person? You need to like vamp for 10 seconds to do that. At least for me, and I don't think I'm terrible at public speaking, but at least for me, that is like one of the most nerve-wracking things ever. Not knowing where you're going and trying to have just figure it out in the spot. That is one that I'm like, fuck, hope it, like this could be an absolute train wreck. And I don't think I'm that nervous or that terrible at public speaking. I don't find it that intimidating, whereas a lot of people do. It's like a big fear for a lot of people. But to do like a 3,000-person show at the Royal Albert Hall with three of your mates and kind of be always in that situation and it turn out like incredibly funny and one of the best things I've seen in years is a staggering achievement. It's just such an impressive talent for it to be genuinely funny as well. Because I reviewed some stuff at the Fringe before when I was trying to get into journalism before I did my master's. I went to the Fringe and worked for a company called 3 Weeks, and I just spent a few weeks at the Fringe reviewing stuff. And obviously the Edinburgh Fringe Festival is like thousands and thousands of acts across 3 weeks. Some of them very, very good. Some of them incredibly, incredibly bad. And one of the things I reviewed was like I can't remember if it was a student group or if it was just like a young actors group, but basically it was the same thing, improvisational comedy sketch shows. It was awful. Like I still remember, this is over 10 years ago, and I remember it as one of the worst things I've ever seen. It lasted like an hour, maybe 45 minutes. The room was, you could hear a pin drop for the entirety of it. It was so bad. It feels that like when you witness something like Ben Schwartz and Friends or Middleditch and Schwartz, if you've got Netflix, I would recommend watching it because it is very funny. When you see something like that, it's very easy to kind of not give it the respect it's due in terms of how much of an achievement it is and how talented they are, because it seems so natural. And you kind of only really realize that when you see a bad version of it, of what it could have been. And when it goes badly, you're like, fuck, this is a train wreck. This is these are some of the most unfunny people I've ever seen in my life. And those people probably were quite funny in their own right, but they just weren't capable of doing that to the necessary standard, because it's such a difficult skill to have. So not only did I love the evening and thought it was a really, really fun way to spend it, it was a really enjoyable show, I was also just incredibly impressed with like the talent that they had to be able to do that and achieve what they achieved that night.
Sure. No, I agree. I think that I completely agree in the sense of, like, my sister played the violin when we were kids. And somebody learning the violin in your house will give you such an appreciation for people who are amazing at the violin.
It really does sound horrible when played badly, doesn't it? The violin specifically.
And it's the same thing. Like, when you go to... I remember going to some improv when I was at uni. Some pretty good and some, like, dire.
Mm.
And after one of the dire ones, I was like, I can't do this to myself anymore. Like, it kills me.
Yeah.
And so when you see it done well, you're like, this is like someone performing a magic trick. Like, I can't quite believe that this is possible. I can't see how it's done. You know? Yeah, agreed. What I'm taking out of the burn book, sunscreen. We're at a time of year. Got to be using your sunscreen all the time. I've probably talked about it before, but it merits being re-upped every single summer. You should actually be using sun cream every single day of the year, but I can't be asked, because I find that sun cream does make you look quite shiny, and no one wants to be like shiny all the time. But I constantly meet people now, to go back to me looking incredibly young and like fresh faced. I constantly meet people now who are like my age or are younger than me, where I'm like, bro, you look old. You look old. Like, sometimes I'll meet someone and I'm like, you're like 38, right? And there's partly that feeling, because as you get older, you still sort of believe
you're young.
It's more like you meet someone and you're like, you're an adult, so therefore you must be older than me. And then sometimes you're like, no, you're an adult, but you're like 29. But there aren't 29-year-old adults, really. But I will quite often meet somebody of about my age or a little bit younger than me, and I will think, your skin looks like you're 40. And I think as well, there's a thing among Brits where they think it makes them sound like more exotic and sophisticated and continental to say they love the sun. They're like, I just love the sun. I hate wearing sun cream. Like, I just love to like lie out in the sun all day. I love the beach, like all this shit. They love doing it. They love talking about this, British people. Sorry, you're still English. Shut up. Just use your sun cream. It's incredibly stupid not to use it, because like, it's very bad for you, like, to just be exposed to the sun all the time. And also, it ages you. It ages you really badly. There are some people who like just look absolutely ancient, and it's purely sun. I do look at a load of people I know and I'm like, why are you so poorly preserved? And then I think it's because you go to like the Med, or you go to like the Caribbean or whatever a couple of times a year, and you go skiing and you don't use sun cream any of the time, and you're just like, I just love to like bake in the sun, and it's catching up to you now.
Like the tanning oil.
Oh my God, crazy. And you're like, it catches up to you. Like, whether you like it or not, like, it does catch up to you. And so just use sun cream. Like, it's quite easy to do. In the summer, I don't think having that slight sheen, that slight glow, like, looks bad. I think it kind of makes you look like healthy in the sun. And it's good for you. And especially if you've got tattoos, especially if you've got pale skin, like, you should do it. But generally, even if you don't have pale skin, like, any color skin can burn. It doesn't matter how exposed you are to the sun generally. Like, you may be like, I tan really well, but like, tanning is legit burning your skin. That is what it is. And you can still tan with sun cream. So like, please just use sun cream. Like, it's really not that hard.
I'm fairly bad at it. Much like all of the essential things you need to put in or on your body, I'm bad at doing.
Sure.
Unless it's to do hair.
Yeah.
But yeah. I've started using moisturizer with 30 in it. It's a moisturizer with 30.
With SPF 30?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, then that's fine. That's all you need to do.
Only like, on my face, though.
That's all you need to do. Like, and similarly, like, if you... you can normally cover up the other areas of your body.
Yeah.
Like, that's a good way to do it. Like, you get a moisturizer with SPF in it. Or, if you don't like using moisturizer, you can literally just get a good quality SPF. Like, not one where it feels like, you know, the supermarket one you had when you were a kid. Like, you don't want to be rubbing that into your face. You can get nicer ones now that are a bit more fluid and feel more like a moisturizer, and just wear that as your moisturizer on your face. Like, you will find you need less moisturizer anyway in the summer, because like, the sun is actually like somewhat good for your skin, and you're not having the same like extremes of hot and cold going inside to outside that you do in the winter. The cold is often worse for your skin in that regard. But like, just get a good sun cream, like, and use it on your face. And honestly, like, it's one of those things that a lot of people don't want to do because it doesn't make you, like, feel better today. But in 15 years' time, you'll look around at your friends and you'll be like, oh my God, like, I am glad I did this. Seriously. So yeah, that's my recommendation. And that's the end of the show. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you for your continued support. Look, if you want to sponsor us, if you work for Coca-Cola or Nike or, you know, one of the organizations that I assume is gagging to work with us, then you just message me. And we could probably work out, like, a very favorable deal, like six-figure deal. But thank you for your continued support. Thank you as well to those of you who subscribe to our Patreon. If you do subscribe to our Patreon, there'll obviously be another episode after this. If you don't subscribe, then consider doing so. It's a pretty reasonable fee. And you can also just throw us a couple of bucks if you fancy that. And we'll see you on the next episode of Unseen Incidents. Bye.